This morning, we were scheduled to get back to the subject of kingdom finances. We spent some time in, I believe it was like February, maybe going into the beginning of March, talking about the place that money has in our lives and the place that God is supposed to have in our money. We covered basic principles from the Bible, things like everything belongs to God. And as the king of our lives, and as the king of all creation, he should be at the center of our financial lives, shaping everything about the way that we handle money. We talked about how money is a blessing, or at least it's meant to be. It's meant to be provision for us and for our loved ones. And it's supposed to be a tool with which we should fulfill God's purposes in the world. I had shared about how after I came to Jesus, I had kind of a negative attitude about money and suspicion of people who had it. And that just didn't sound right to me. It took a while to shake some of that loose, which I'll try to get to this morning. We talked about how money easily becomes an idol, a false god that we will worship by believing its promises and worshiping it, that is, by orienting our lives to maximize its presence and power in our lives. We talked about how money reveals who and what we really trust, love, and value. When you want to know about someone's faith, you can always ask them and they could explain it in words. But a more reliable way to know what people really believe in is to look at how they handle their money. What do they spend it on? Where do they give it? Do they give it at all? Or do they hoard it? We learned that tithing, that is the dedication of the first part of our income or our increase to God, traditionally a tenth, a tithe means a tenth, that tithing is not about giving God his cut. Like 10% belongs to him and the rest is all ours, as much as it is a spiritual discipline which reminds us that everything belongs to God. Everything comes from God, and everything is meant to be put into the service of his purposes and mission in the world, and that we are meant to put our trust in him and not in money. This morning, we're going to have a different kind of message on money. We're going to have a message about making money. I don't know if you've been coming to church long or not. If not, we don't always talk about money like this. This just happens to be a series on money, the first one in my 3.5 years as a pastor at Redemption. I would say in some ways we're kind of overdue on that front. But if you've been around this church or any church for a while, I'm going to bet that you've not heard a message about making money, about creating wealth. Often when we talk about money, we talk about not worshiping it. We talk about giving it, but we don't talk much beyond that. And in these next several weeks, I want to kind of expand our view of what we can talk about in church when we talk about money, because it turns out that creating wealth is not only okay, like it's not only acceptable, it is a commission from God who gives us the power to create wealth. God intends for us to make money and to partner with him in the world financially. But like I said earlier in the series, there was a time when I had a much more negative view of money. I just thought of money as something that, you know, it's a false god that people worshiped, and I wasn't going to do that. And so I made little money, and I gave away much of what I made. I was actually pretty satisfied with that arrangement, this sort of simple view of the world that money is bad, and by extension, people that have much of it are bad, or at least they're suspect. But as a young InterVarsity staff worker, not dissimilar to Tim going on staff with UCM, I was also not entirely at peace. So partly I wasn't at peace because I was being blessed by people who had money. As an InterVarsity staff worker, I had financial partners whose generosity made the ministry possible. They donated money. They also donated goods and services, sometimes their homes, to help us do outreach to students or train students, to give us a space in which to hear God. And I was super grateful for them, of course, and for the investment that they were making in me and in the ministry on campus. I wasn't thrown off just because I was the beneficiary. I could see that these people loved Jesus. And I could see how purposeful they were and how they managed their resources. They were intentional about using them to support and extend God's kingdom work in the world. And it didn't seem like their riches were a distraction that kept them from God. Money and the other cares of the world weren't choking God out of their lives. So I had to revisit the biblical evidence. You know, there is Bible evidence to suggest that we need to be careful, that money will be a false god, that money will choke out our life with God. But apparently, it didn't have to be that way. And there was other biblical evidence that I hadn't accounted for that we're going to look at this morning. Evidence that indicates that God intends money as a blessing and calls for us to grow it wisely and diligently. Honestly, that kind of fit with an internal sense I had that good stewardship, good management of God's money meant more than just giving it away. It meant handling it well in multiple areas of life, including planning for the future. For instance, there's going to be a day when at least some of us, maybe all of us, aren't going to be able to work anymore. And how are we supposed to prepare for that? Some people would say, don't prepare. Like young Barry would have said, don't prepare. Spend it, give it away now, and just trust that God will provide it later. But what if some of what God intends is that some of what's given now is also meant to provide for us and others later, and that we need to manage it well? We're going to look at multiple Bible passages today, and it looks like, looking at my timer, we're going to have to go pretty quick. The main passage is going to be Deuteronomy 8, and I'll also do a little drive through Proverbs 31. We'll take a look and see how this works out, just to let you know where I'm headed ahead of time. I think all of these Bible passages are sort of summed up in two main ideas. The first one is that creating wealth is a gift from God. It's meant to be a good thing. It's meant to be used to pursue His purposes, which include our being housed and fed, clothed, but also that we would be able to engage in the mission of God in the world. So we should not be shy or apologetic about creating wealth. The second main idea here is going to be that how we make wealth matters. We are called to do so honestly, wisely, and with justice. So I'll talk more about what that means, but the little spoiler alert is that it's more than just being an honest person, more than just obeying the laws of the land. There's something else that we're supposed to be concerned about as we make money, as we create wealth. And so we need to pay attention to that. All right, Deuteronomy 8. I'm going to speed through this relatively quickly. I'll read the passage and then I'll extract three things that I want us to see from this passage. All the commandments that I'm commanding you today, you shall be careful to do. So this is God talking to the people, His people, Israel. you should be careful to do so that you may live and increase and go in and take possession of the land which the Lord swore to your forefathers. And then verse 3, he humbled you and let you go hungry and fed you with manna that you did not know, nor did your fathers know, in order to make you understand that people should not live on bread alone, but shall live on everything that comes out of the mouth of the Lord. And then skipping, I think this might be verse 5. I cut it off here. So you are to know in your heart that the Lord your God was disciplining you. He was instructing you, training you, just as a father disciplines his son. Therefore, you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God to walk in his ways and to fear him. The Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, in a land of streams of water, of fountains and springs flowing out in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines, fig trees, and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land where you will eat food without shortage, in which you will not lack anything, a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you have eaten and are satisfied, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. And then he says this, verse 11, be careful that you do not forget the Lord your God by failing to keep his commandments, his ordinances, and his statutes, which I'm commanding you today. Otherwise, when you eat and are satisfied, and you build houses and live in them, and when your herds and your flocks increase, and your silver and gold increase, and everything that you have increases, then your heart will become proud, and you will forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, he who led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and its thirsty ground where there was no water. He who brought water for you out of the rock of flint. In the wilderness, it was God who fed you manna that your fathers did not know, in order to humble you and in order to put you to the test to do good for you in the end. Otherwise, you might say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. But you are to remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you the power to make wealth in order to confirm his covenant, which he swore to your fathers as it is to this day. All right, so a few highlights. We won't be able to unpack all of that, but a few highlights. God allows lean times. He allowed them for the people of Israel, his original people, but he allows them for us as well. Why? Well, he tells us that the lean times were to form us, to discipline us, to teach us that provision comes from God, and to learn to heed his words, to trust and obey him, lest we become proud, self-sufficient, and deceived into thinking that we've done it all ourselves. If you ever wonder, like, if God loves me, why do I struggle financially? Why do I live into some of these lean times? There are people who will say, you know what? You just need to claim the promise. You just need to confess it, and then you'll possess it. That's not what it says here. What it says here is God intentionally has us live in seasons of little so that we can be formed according to his desire, so that we can learn the truth that life does not consist in the abundance of our things and that everything comes from God. We are not supposed to look for things. We are supposed to look for him. God does allow lean times, and we need to cooperate with those times, to allow ourselves to be shaped by God, to have our character and our desires, our longings redirected. You know, maybe I really, really, really want to drive a Tesla. You know, just the longing of my heart. It's actually not. I don't care what I drive. But For some people, that might be true. God, in his wisdom, allows us to walk through times with less so that we might learn the things that really matter. Second thing that I think we can get from this passage, God provides for the people of Israel miraculously on their journey to the promised land, and he'll provide for us miraculously too. But get this, his intention was not to provide miraculously forever. I'm not saying that God couldn't do a miracle. I'm saying that God's intention for his people was not that they would have to get manna from heaven every day for the rest of their lives. The manna was a gift. It sustained them in a particular season of life, a desert season. But God meant to deliver them into the land, and he expected them to cultivate it, to learn what was there, the iron and the copper, and to figure out how to mine it, to see the things that could grow there, the figs, the pomegranates, and all the grains, to pay attention to how the land was meant to produce, and then to coax that into fruitfulness. He meant for them to learn to use the resources of the land wisely, to produce for themselves and for one another and even beyond. They weren't just supposed to live on whatever they found in the land. They were supposed to learn how to make the land really fruitful. And I think there's an analog here for us as well. God will provide for us miraculously. He's done that for me and for my family over and over again. But hear this. I don't think that God's intention was that I would always have to just wait around for him to do some miraculous thing. There's some things that God sets up so that we can partner with him in it. And I think part of what he means for us to do is to learn how our land works. How does the financial world work? How can we take part of what is given to us and have it produce fruitfully? Some of you've heard that, you know, rich people, their money works for them. And I'm here to tell you today that that doesn't just have to be rich people. I've learned a bit about ways that the world is set up and we can invest our money in ways that it will become fruitful, it will produce. Third thing I think we can see from this passage is that God's ultimate intention is that we would have more than enough. So while it's true that we will have seasons of leanness and we don't have to think, oh, I must be doing something wrong, I must be in sin. I mean, you might be in sin, and if you are, you should repent. But there are other reasons that you go through lean times. But God's ultimate intention is that they would have more than enough, that we would have more than enough. And to accomplish this, it says there at the end of that passage I read that God gave them the power to create wealth. He meant for them to be able to make a living, at least in a collective sense. So I understand that there might be individuals that have a harder time with that, either because of some kind of physical or mental disability or what have you. The living that God meant for them to make was kind of a collective living, that they would be able to take care of each other. I think that's three things we can see from that passage. What does it look like enacted in real life? What does it look like? Well, I'm gonna take a quick spin through many biblical passages now. You might be better off to just write these down because I doubt you'll be able to flip through them quick enough to get to them all. But here are some things I think we can gather. A first principle is, in general, we need to work. Proverbs 24, verses 30 through 34 says, I passed by the field of a lazy person and by the vineyard of a person lacking sense. And behold, it was completely overgrown with weeds. Its surface was covered with weeds and its stone wall was broken down. And when I saw, I reflected upon it and I looked and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and then poverty will come like a drifter and your need like an armed man. Proverbs 28:19, one who works the land will have plenty of food, but one who follows empty pursuits will have plenty of poverty. Proverbs 14:23, in all labor there's profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. Now, I want to be careful about how we read these things. These things are not like ironclad laws. I think they're general principles. It was possible for a farmer to do everything right and have a crop wiped out by a hailstorm or by drought. So I understand that these things are general principles and not like a promise that it's going to happen this way every single time. However, I do think that we can draw from this that God intends for us to work when we're able to do that. And God means to provide for us, but that provision ordinarily includes our participation. It's not that God can't provide miraculously. It's that He loves to partner with us in fulfilling His purposes in the world, including that we would have an abundance, that we would have enough to share with our neighbor in need. While God could drop a bag of money from the sky, and frankly, I've had a few things happen that were close to that over the years, He often requires action or effort on our part. Some of the most hilarious part of this, and this could be a message to Tim and Chris and Michelle. In my life, part of the way this worked was that we had to fundraise to be able to make a living on InterVarsity staff. But what I noticed was that sometimes I would give the effort, like I would reach out to people, I would tell them about what we're doing, I would ask them to join my support team, and it wouldn't work. Like I would go through talking to, you know, my supervisor would say, you know, you need to talk to 10 people this week. And so I would do that, and I might get zero supporters out of those people that I talked to. And yet God still seemed to honor the effort. I'd ask and I wouldn't see the result from people that I was asking. And then somebody would come out of nowhere, sometimes people I didn't know, to offer to be part of my support team. And I found that that was fairly common, not just for me, but for other people, that we needed to put in the work, but we also needed to recognize that provision's from God, right? Work is important, and sometimes God honors the work by having it come from somewhere else. We need to work, at least to the degree that we're able. Now, I recognize some of us have physical conditions that make that difficult. Here I am with the COVID, right? So we can only do what we can do, and we don't need to feel guilty when we are not able to work. That's a whole different situation. But when we're able, we need to put in the work that we can, and then we trust God. Second biblical principle here, we need to plan and plan wisely. Proverbs 21:5, the plans of the diligent lead surely to advantage, but everyone who is hasty comes surely to poverty. I think once upon a time I thought that faith and planning were opposites, that planning was incompatible with faith, that if we really trusted God, we wouldn't have a plan. We would just trust God to provide. But it turns out that God means for us to plan, and that an unwillingness to plan can have severe consequences. And we recognize this in the rest of life, right? A farmer plans a crop. They have to figure out what will grow and under what conditions. They have to fertilize and water and nurture if there's going to be a crop. But I would argue that all of that planning and work are acts of faith. They're not a substitute for faith. They're showing that they want to put themselves in a position to receive from God, but they have to do work on their side to be in that position. It's still possible that something could happen beyond the farmer's control. The weather could be too hot for too long. There could be drought. There could be, too much rain or insufficient sunshine or what have you. There could be pests. And it is a faith move to plant and to believe that there will still be a crop, that God will bring his part. So planning is not incompatible with faith. In fact, I think planning done rightly can be a way to demonstrate our faith. If we will invest wisely for retirement, that God will multiply the seed that we've planted. And that's a third thing that I think we can get from the Bible. Third biblical principle is that we should invest, and that we should invest wisely. We should not only make money in a paycheck, we should invest it so that it can grow. Proverbs 13:11 says, "Wealth obtained from nothing dwindles, but one who gathers by labor," or some versions say, "one who gathers little by little increases it." Proverbs 21:20, "The wise store up choice food and olive oil, but the fool gulps theirs down." And then Ecclesiastes 11:1-2, "Ship your grain across the sea. After many days, you may receive a return. Invest in 7 ventures. Yes, in 8. You do not know what disaster may come upon the land." So all of these, I believe, are passages about how we make money and how we invest it, right? We don't just count on a windfall, like the lottery or something. That kind of money tends to go away. But the one who gathers by little and by their labor, that person grows it, right? The wise person stores up food. They don't eat it all at one time. They plan for how it's going to get used. It's foolish to just gulp it all down. And then this passage from Ecclesiastes about diversification, about having investment in more than one area. You know that thing about losing money if you get it all at one time, whether it's an inheritance or like lottery winnings or something? That's true. Like, that's proven out in contemporary research. The percentage of lottery winners who go bankrupt is higher than for those who don't win the lottery. It's nearly 1/3 of lottery winners go bankrupt. Pro athletes who make millions of dollars. I don't have the percentage here in front of me. I saw it. But an obscene number of these athletes go bankrupt within like 5 years of the end of their career. Now, why does that happen? There are multiple reasons. I think when people have a lot of money, they get pressure from friends and family. There are scammers that come around. There's all kinds of bad things that happen. But one of the reasons why people that get money quickly tend to lose it quickly is because they haven't learned to manage it with discipline and wisdom. They didn't make it a little at a time, and they haven't learned to manage it. In one publicized case, there was a guy in West Virginia who won $315 million and lost it all in 4 years. Among the other things that happened to him, he had $500,000 stolen from his car. Like, who has $500,000 in their car? But this is what happens when you don't know about how to handle money well. And so this is a freebie for you. Don't keep $500,000 in your car. That's stupid. And there are a lot of other stupid things we do, like putting all of our money into a single investment. That's not investing. That's speculating. You're like betting on the roulette wheel that your number's going to come up. And if it does, you're going to win big. According to researcher Tom Corley, 65% of millionaires have at least three streams of income: earned income, investment income, rental income, royalties, capital gains, profits from a business that they own, interest income. And this is actually modeled in that Proverbs 31 passage that some of you read this week. So the ideal wife is what Proverbs 31 is about. But look at what she's like. Verses 13 through 15, she's a hard, productive worker. Verse 16, she considers, then buys a field and plants a vineyard from her earnings. Verse 24, she makes and sells linen garments and belts. Verse 20, she cares for the poor. So she knows how to save. She's an entrepreneur. She got multiple streams of income going on here. And she has God's heart. She knows that her money isn't just for herself or her family. She's interested in what God is doing in the broader world as well, in caring for and meeting the needs of other people. Well, I'm going to try to skate through the rest of this a little bit more quickly here. Next biblical principle is we need to create wealth justly. Proverbs 22:16 says that one who oppresses the poor to make more for himself or to give to the rich will only come to poverty. James 5, verse 4 says, "Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of hosts, the Lord of armies." When we talk about how we make money and talk about doing it justly, we're not just talking about obeying the law. I mean, you should do that too. We're talking about caring for other people while you do it. We're talking about giving to those in need. We're talking about treating employees and other workers fairly, ensuring that they're being treated well. You know, I think by extension, we need to be careful about the ways that we make money. And then finally, the biblical principle, and I won't give one verse for this because it's all throughout the Bible, is that God is the one who provides. No matter how hard we work, how clever we are investing, how much, you know, how well we budget and save and all these different things, God is the one who makes grace overflow to us so that we will have all sufficiency in everything. What can we take home? One, we need to revisit our attitudes about money. Just as some of us may err on the side of worshiping money and becoming greedy, others of us may be guilty of rejecting the gift that God means for money to be. We may also consciously or unconsciously have judgments toward people who've amassed a certain amount of wealth. I think ultimately it's for God to be the judge as to when people have been wise in amassing wealth and when they've been greedy and their wealth is problematic. I can tell you that from my personal experience, I know that certain wealthy people have been great ministry partners and friends to me and Michelle. And so we shouldn't paint with too fat a brush. We need to ask God to search us and to know our hearts and see if there's any hurtful way in us. A second takeaway is you should consider reading a book on personal finance. I don't know if you've ever done that, you know, or taken a course on personal finance, but we aren't born knowing how to handle money or how to create wealth. It comes, that knowledge comes from somewhere. So whether it's a book, a course, or maybe talking to a friend who is godly and further along, we need to get that information. We need to be purposeful and learn somehow. And just warning you ahead of time, I can recommend a couple of places to start in terms of your research, but you will have to be discerning. Because some of the people that know a lot about how to be smart with money don't have God's values at all. And so you have to learn to discern between the wisdom of how to handle money well and the heart of God for what to do once you've handled it well. A couple of possible starting places for you. There's a short book called Your Money or Your Life by Vicki Robin. Would not ascribe to her spiritual beliefs, pretty much just inferred from what she wrote, but a helpful starting place of a book. There's a free place that you can go online, a series of blog articles called The Stock Series by J.L. Collins. You can just look it up by Googling J.L. Collins Stock Series, and it'll come up. Something like 30 articles for free. It was so good, it ended up becoming a book, but as a service, he's just left it out there on the internet. A third possible takeaway for some of you, probably not for everybody, but maybe for some, is to embrace the power to create wealth. It is a gift from God for yourself and for those who might depend on you. Could be your family, could be your neighbors. And you know, part of embracing the creating of wealth might be to consider cultivating another stream of income, some other way. This is gig economy, right? Everybody's got a side hustle. You know, is there something like that that God might lead you into, not just so that you'll have money, but for the sake of His kingdom? And we'll talk about what that money could do in the coming days. All right. Well, I'm going to pray for us now. Father, to know You and to know Jesus is to have life. Thank You for the promise of Your Spirit who comes to make His home in us so that we could have the power to live a supernatural life. And I pray, Lord, that with respect to money, that we would be better, that we would handle it more wisely and more generously and more joyfully. Help us to figure out our next step, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.